Hello, this is the podcast for class number 22 on November 8th, and we continue to talk about affirmative defenses. As remember, we moved away from showing that the defendant was negligent. Now the defendant's now we're focusing on the plaintiff's conduct because the defendant is now saying, well, yeah, I was negligent, but so were you, or there's some other reason why I shouldn't be held responsible that would break my liability. And we moved on to talk about assumption of risk, and this is something that there's everybody knows the words, the term, but there's a lot of misconception about. So it's important that you truly understand what assumption of risk means. We talked about two types of assumption of risk, express and implied. Express assumption of risk is just that you've manifested it by writing, by checking a box. You have expressly agreed to relieve the defendant of any responsibility, any duty towards you. So, as we've always said, no duty, no breach, no negligence. An express assumption of risk means that you've said they don't have any duty towards you. Relieve them of the duty. And if there's no duty, if there's truly a valid express assumption of risk, then the case is over at the summary judgment stage. Because remember, we've always said that's what summary judgment for. It's either stops it at duty, stops it at breach. If there's no duty, you don't even move forward to anything else. So it's not truly an affirmative defense, because an affirmative defense says I was negligent, but so were you. But it's an affirmative defense in that I have here a valid expression of their assumption of risk. So express assumption of risk, all it is just a contract. You know, you said I agree to this. What's the consideration? You're allowed to do something, participate in something. So the most common forms of express assumption of risks are waivers. And in the waivers are just, or releases. They're just releasing the other party from any duty. So the big question when you're confronted with a waiver or release is it valid on its face? You know, is it a good contract? Does it show you on its face from its words exactly what you're agreeing to? And, you know, or is it unclear? Is it vague? Is it misleading? So just like any written document, you can attack it on its face. Or is there some reason as a policy matter, as a matter of public policy, that we don't want any, even valid, waivers to be considered to relieve the defendant of a duty? So even though valid on its face as a written document, is there any public policy reason why it should be void and not effective to relieve the defendant of the duty? So we see in the Dowry case, it was a ski lift at Killington, now I'm was pointed out, and the release, very common release, very well drafted document, you know, not a bad, you know, the document itself was not the problem. It wasn't vague, it wasn't void, there was nothing wrong with the release. But nonetheless, the court said, as a matter of public policy, we're not going to uphold this. We're not going to say you cannot release this ski lift from its own negligence. And that's what the big question is, of course. The document said that we will not proceed in the action, even if you're negligent. situation, you relieve somebody from having any duty of care towards you. And the court said, well, they examined releases in general using the Tunkel factors, and you cannot go wrong with using the Tunkel factors. There are also other factors, and the court talked about it, to examine releases. Tunkel is a six-part test and is referred to quite frequently. So the idea is there anything under Tunkel that would make this release void, would make it so that it's not going to be upheld? Is it against public policy based on the six Tunkel factors? So the court looked at the ski resorts, and certainly they're not like hospitals. They're not like charitable institutions. There's nothing in that respect that would jump out at you that would make you want to think that there's some reason that they shouldn't be upheld. They shouldn't be able to release. People shouldn't be able to sign away their rights to sue. But here, the court focused on one aspect of the Tunkel factor, the idea that the person or property of the purchaser is placed under the control of the seller, subject to the risk of carelessness by the seller or the seller's agent or whoever. And that strikes this court as incompatible with our premises liability law, which also puts somebody under, control and subject to their carelessness. And as it says, the major public policy implications are those underlying the law of premises liability. We've talked about that before, that it's only the owner of the premises that can fully make sure that the conditions are safe. And the court, through premises liability law, through our owner-occupier law, the court has a valid reason for wanting to make sure that the premises are safe. General public safety. Here, and the court also says, if we didn't have this, if we allowed waiver for negligence for these premises, these conditions, then there'd be no incentive for making anything safe. And that's certainly against our public policy. Safety has its role. So here, the court says they're not going to allow the valid waiver. You have to look at the circumstances, too, that they got hit by a post on the way to the – or they hit a post, a metal post, on the way to the ski lift. That's not inherent in skiing. That's something outside that at all. So the idea of you can't use our implied assumption of risk, so we'll talk about later, something inherent in the activity, getting hit by a metal post at the ski lift line isn't inherent. And negligence is never an inherent risk. So the idea is, does the is it appropriate here to have a waiver? The court says no. Do we know that the plaintiff's going to win? No, absolutely not. They still have to show negligence. They still have to, all of the things they have to show that it was unreasonable to have that metal post there. So it's not clear that they win, but it's not going to get stopped at the summary judgment stage. So if you're looking at a waiver or release, look to see the activities, look to see what they're what is being released, and then also look to the language of the release itself. Next, we moved on to implied assumption of risk. And that means just by your conduct, just taking part in the conduct, just by your choosing to participate, are you impliedly assuming the risk of that activity? And then we saw, of course, my very, very favorite case, Murphy v. Steeplechase. Why is it my favorite? Well, of course, we all love Cardozo, and Cardozo's language is the most flowery here. The timorous may stay at home. The adventuresome ride the flopper. Here, Cardozo was saying, he looks at this and he says, well, nobody claimed that there was something about the flopper that was dangerous. Nobody was making that claim. They could have, but they didn't. That it was there was some negligence in not having enough padding and not doing this. The plaintiff, Cardozo says, just looked at the the jerking motion of the flopper. He saw people on it, watched it, decided to get on. And at the point of deciding to get on, Cardozo says that he assumed the risk of that activity. And by doing that, you release the defendant from any duty. So no duty, no negligence. So Cardozo, we've seen that before where he stops the activity at the duty phase. We saw it in Paul's graph. He's Mr. Duty, remember? There's no sense that's all there is to Cardozo. But again, by choosing to participate in an activity, when do you release the defendant from any duty? We'll see in the next case, the Davenport case, why this is really important under comparative negligence. What difference does it make? No duty, no negligence, or no negligence, no liability. What difference does it make? It makes a huge difference to our defendant under comparative negligence. So think about that. The idea of, though, implied assumption of risk for sporting events has great traction and continues down to this day. What's an inherent risk in a touch football game? Is it that you're going to get hit? Yeah, sure. So don't complain. What's the inherent risk in any sort of activity? Any sort of voluntary activity. The courts are going to look, and these are just strings and strings of cases discussing inherent risk. What's the inherent risk in any sporting activity? Is the inherent risk in going to a health club being sitting on a bench that collapses and injures you? No. The inherent risk is maybe pulling a muscle, doing all kinds of things, but not being injured by negligently maintained furniture. Same thing with going to a baseball game. You look on your ticket, it says, I release you from this, that, and the other, your negligence, but is it an inherent, so we know that that's not going to fly. Is it an inherent risk that you go to a baseball game, get hit by a ball or a bat? Sure, but having your seat collapse under you or some concrete fall on you from the negligently maintained ceiling? No. So the idea of the inherent risk is in any activity is subject of much litigation. Anyway, so next class we're going to talk about again implied assumption of risk outside of the sporting event arena, and at the most at a very important time, because since we're into comparative negligence, when will the plaintiff's actions in the face of negligence, when will the plaintiff's actions be negligent in and of themselves, or when will they just have assumed the risk of the negligence? When will they be taken to have assumed the risk of the negligence of the defendant, and what difference does it make? Also, next class, we'll talk about the firefighter's rule. It had been eliminated in New York and then readopted, eliminated by legislation, and then legislation was repealed, and also preemption in the famous Geyer case. This is a Supreme Court case. It's very difficult reading. Please do your best. Please prepare this case very carefully. Just don't skim over it, because you'll lose the important part of preemption. And preemption is one of the major areas, not just in constitutional law, but in major tort litigation these days. Also, please look on the website. I've included a New York Times editorial that appeared a couple of weeks ago talking about another preemption case that's working its way through the courts now. So next class, we're going to continue on and finish up on defenses.